right, everybody. So I think it's always good when you study a long book like Romans is. And it's a book that's, you might say it's involved. I mean, there's an argument. And I don't think that the argument is super difficult, but I noticed that when I'm reading something that it's like links of a chain, and there's one link goes with another link goes with another link, and it's not so much that any one link is difficult, it's just you got to keep going, you got to keep concentrating, keep them all together, and sometimes it's easy to blink, get distracted, and the next thing you know, you've kind of lost the train of argument. So I think it's good for us to periodically kind of step back and see where we are. So as we just look at Romans chapter 1, kind of work our way to where we are today, there's an introductory section, and then Paul states what this book is about. And if you were going to say in a word what this book is about, what would you say it is about? All right, that would be one word. That's going to be a part of it for sure. I'm thinking it's, I'm sorry, say it again. All right, justification, that's going to be a big part of this. Neither one of those are the words I was thinking of, though, but you can make a good argument for them for sure. The word I'm looking for is in verse 16. Yeah, I would say this book is about the gospel. And now, it's about the gospel that we are to have faith in. So that's why Keith said faith, which is a good. And that faith is how we are justified. That's why Brother George said justification. Justification by faith would have been another good answer as well. But Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. And that's what he intends to come someday and share with them in person. But in the meantime, he's sharing it in writing. And then if you look in verse 17, Romans 1, 17, what does Paul say is revealed in the gospel? The righteousness of God. That's exactly right. In it, the righteousness of God is revealed. And we talked about different ideas of what that means. What is our operating definition of the righteousness of God for our purpose in this class? All right, that it is God's faithfulness to keep his promises, and particularly his saving promises, that God is faithful to his word. And that's why I think the very next phrase there in Romans 1:17 talks about from faith to faith or faith for faith, which I understand to be from God's faithfulness to our faithfulness, although there's, as we talked about in class, many other options. All right, so then there is the faith, the righteousness of God, his faithfulness to his saving promises, which then leads to this question, well, why do we need those saving promises? So what's the simple one-word answer to why we need those saving promises? Sin, that's exactly right. And who has sinned? Everybody has. So that's the next part. So what does Romans 1, 18 through 32 focus on? The sins of the Gentiles. That's why the Gentiles need the saving promises of God, because they have rejected God in idolatry, no longer honor God as God. And so that's why they need it. And where we are going to study today is when you start in chapter 2 and verse 17, who else needs the saving righteousness of God? The Jews do. That's right. So that's where we're headed. And then in between, end of Romans 1 and then chapter 2, verse 17, we have these first 16 verses. And what do those first 16 verses, what's the main point of those? What are they trying to get across? That God is not partial. That is exactly right. You can see this spelled out in verse 11, chapter 2, verse 11. God shows no partiality. So the train of thought then is the gospel is about the saving faithfulness of God to keep his promises. That's his righteousness. And we all need it. The Gentiles need it. And the next point is God is impartial. So he's going to judge everybody on the basis of their conduct. That's why the Gentiles need the saving promises of God. And then after making that point, today what we're going to see is, and because God is impartial, guess who else needs the saving promises of God? The Jews are going to need it. So that's the train of thought where we've been so far. Now Brad is going to try to derail our train of thought. Yes, Brad. Yeah, that's Brad just made what I think is a very insightful point. He said he looks at this book as a book about unification. And in what I would say is that that's not mutually exclusive from the gospel, that that is in fact one of the points of the gospel. And if you think about what you guys have already just told me in your review of the book, Jews and Gentiles are already united in one sense. They're all sinners. So there's unity there, and they will be united in salvation, saved the same way, and then that unity needs to be lived out in the fellowship that they share with each other, which is the reason Brad is bringing this up, is because chapters 9, 10, and 11, they're going to talk about the relationship of Jews and Gentiles and God's purpose. And then chapter 14, the first part of chapter 15, is going to talk about how to live out that relationship. So there very much is a lot about unity as a consequence of the gospel. That's great. Very good. All right, was there any leftover questions or comments, anything we need to get back into before we move on ahead with the section we're going to pick up with today? We good to go? Get started today here? All right, so we just finished then 2:1-16, which says God's impartial. Sort of a setup. If you're a Jew in the audience listening to Paul hammer the Gentiles, you are all over it. You are amening, hallelujahing, throwing songbooks in the air, turning cartwheels. You are just so excited that Paul has given these pagans the what for. And then Paul says, well, you know, God's impartial, and he's going to judge Jews and Gentiles. And then your collar starts to get just a little tighter. And then we come to chapter 2 and verse 17. But if you call yourself a Jew. Now, at this point, Paul is going to list 5 qualities of identity. 5 qualities of identity. So the first one is, if you do what? Yeah, well, the first one actually is, if you call yourself a Jew. Yeah, and that has to do with just that's the way that in this day and time, if you were a person descended from Abraham, that's the term Hebrew, Israelite. Those have sort of fallen out of use. Now it is really a Jew. If you call yourself a Jew, it's a way of identity. And as I understand it, particularly during the time between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New, when the Jewish people came under assault in persecution and so forth, that this was a term that really then started to take off as a way of identification. So the first thing is here, if you call yourself a Jew, what's the second one? Darren? And rely on the law. That's exactly right. And you see, the one flows from the other, because after all, what defines who or what a Jew is? Well, it is the law that does that, and you're relying on that. That's your identity. And think about all the different ways the law established a separate, distinct identity for Jews as opposed to Gentiles, with circumcision, the food laws, the holy days, all of those kind of things. So number one, if you call yourself a Jew. Number two, rely on the law. Number three, what's number three? You boast in God, as opposed to the Gentiles who have turned away from God, who have traded God away, who've traded God away for idolatry and no longer give honor to him. So you boast in God. What's number four? You know his will because you have the law. And then what's number five? Because you know the law, you know what's good and you know what's not good. You know what to give the thumbs up to and you know what to give the thumbs down to. You know what, how to approve what is excellent because you are instructed in the law. So, 5 sort of ways of identifying yourself as a Jew. And then from that, we're going to have another list of 5. 5 claims of superiority. So let's take a look at these. What's number 1 in verse 19? And if you are sure that you yourself are a guide to the blind, which says two things. Number one, there are some people that you consider in blindness. And number two, you think you can see, and so that's why you are a guide to the blind. So that's the first one. What's the second one? A light to those who are in darkness, which is very similar, of course, to the first one, if you think about it. And, I mean, there is certainly a sense in which, in theory, Israel could be these things. That they could be a guide to those who are in blindness, because there is no question that the Gentile world, one of the prophets says it's like their eyes have been smudged over in idolatry. So there's no question that they are in a kind of spiritual blindness and that they need some help. And there's no question that God caused Israel to be a light to the nations. That's what Isaiah says, that Israel is supposed to be. So there is a sense in which these things could be true. So a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness. What's the third one? An instructor of the foolish. Yeah, that's right. And if you go back to chapter 1, remember, what does Paul say about the Gentiles in verse 22? Claiming to be wise, they became fools. So an instructor to the foolish, that's how the Gentile world would certainly look to them. So I think that was number, a guide to the blind, light to the darkness, instructor to the foolish. What's the fourth one? A teacher of, what does yours say? Babes, children, infants. So looking at those who don't have what you have is they are mere children, you know, they're juvenile. They're just babes, whereas you are the wise and the mature who can instruct them. And then having in the law, the fifth one is the embodiment of knowledge and truth. So we started off with five statements of identity, and then we have five claims of superiority, and then guess what's about to happen next? Somebody say it. That's right. So Paul has been polishing up a big old sledgehammer as he lists all of these things, and now he's about to take it and clobber them right over the head with it. And notice then, how does the next verse start? Verse 21, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? And so now he's going to make a list of different behaviors that they have that talk about their failures. And just take a wild guess how many items he's going to list. How did you come up with that, Troy? That is exactly right. So there's going to be five of these. So number one, he says, while you preach against stealing, do you not steal? You who say that one must not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Here's the next one. This is interesting. You who abhor idols, do what? Yeah, it says rob temples. And as I understand it, there is a lot of debate in commentaries as to exactly what this means. Now, one possibility is it could mean what? They're robbing temples. Adam, you're my man who just cuts straight to the chase. Exactly right. It could just mean flatly and plainly exactly what it says. Now, if you think about it, think about the way Paul puts this. He says, you abhor idols. Oh, they're just so horrible. They're so detestable. But at the same time, you don't have any problem breaking the window out of the temple, or however they did it, and crawling inside and snatching one so maybe you can go and, you know, sell it for its valuable as a commodity, as a piece of gold, or so forth. That's what a lot of people think that Paul is talking about here. I want to warn you guys, two congregations in the past that I have preached for have been broken into. The buildings have. And a third one, the preacher's house was broken into. So actually, now I say that incriminates me, right? Like, I'm the common denominator in all these crimes. So forget that I brought this up. The one in Elgin, Illinois, it was really funny to me in a way. Somebody broke in the building and they stole our projector, which is up, and the only way they could have gotten it is we had like an 18-foot ladder in the work closet, And so they had to have gotten the ladder out to get up there to get it, but they put the ladder back. I thought, you know, if you're going to be a thief, be a considerate thief, I guess. And then the congregation where I was in Nashville, not long after I moved away, somebody broke into the building and somebody outside saw it and called the police. And so the police got into the building and started chasing the guy, and the lights were off, and he didn't see where he was running. So he ran into a door, ran up some stairs, ran through that door, and fell into the baptistry, which then raises a theological question as to whether his sins were remitted or not. While he was, you know, to what extent is he culpable there? But anyway, so it's just kind of funny. But so, yeah, here Paul's talking about robbing temples. And just for the sake of argument, I'm going to kind of go with that is basically what he's saying. I don't have a lot of information, honestly, on how common this would have been, how typical a practice this would have been. But just knowing people, I mean, people do break into buildings all the time. They break into church property all the time. There's nothing that would be, you know, super weird about the idea that they might have done that. Yeah, Jackson.
But to what extent do we know how well Paul would have known these like faulted characters, or was some part of like the spirit of action, like inspiration, or what? How can you?
Yeah, so Jackson's asking a really good question. Some of these charges seem so specific. It's like, how does Paul know that these things are in fact the things that are, because of all the things he could have listed, you know, like why these things? And I don't have like any particular insight to answer that question other than to say part of it may be because in a way these are pretty typical sins if you go back and look in the Old Testament. So if not idolatry, at least, you know, doing something with idols obviously is very common. It does seem like after the Babylonian captivity and all that the Jews went through, it did kind of sort of solve the idolatry problem. But this is sort of like the next step close to that. And if you think about it, like, I just think off the top of my head, in Jeremiah 7, when he says, "Will you come to this house which is called by my name and lie and steal and commit adultery and bear false witness and then say the temple of the Lord," you know, and he says it's become a house, a den of thieves. So if you think about it, a lot of those just in that one passage are right here. So I would say it's something like that. Hang on to all the other comments. There's like 17 hands just went up, and I left my man Paul hanging over here, and I got to get to him, and then I'll come right back to everybody, I promise. Yeah, Paul. Sure. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So Paul's talking about sort of stealing would be sort of something you do more by in secret and by stealth, whereas robbing is a more overt kind of thing. So that's another way to kind of distinguish these two things here. Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe because just like today, both are done. He's seen that as something done. And again, particularly, I think the way to think about this is if you follow sort of the train of argument, it's the hypocrisy of claiming you find idols detestable, and then you want to go break in and rob and grab them. It'd be that kind of thing. All right, I saw like a bunch of hands go up. So I'll start here with Adam, and we'll just work our way around, okay? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was there when they were killing Jesus' followers. It seems to me he's maybe speaking from experience, and he knows what goes on.
I love what Adam just said, kind of going back to your point, that Paul does have substantial insider knowledge of the sins of the Jews because he is one. And particularly, you know, in his life before he became a Christian, would be aware of what some of the faults and tendencies are. And then if you combine that with just the legacy of the Old Testament, you could probably see how this goes. Maybe Justin and Ed, I'm so sorry, this is not going to be in the order that I saw the hands go up. Sorry about that. Oh, okay. Yeah, and so just to make the point, you know, idolatry can have a broader meaning than just simply with reference to an image. And whether that's what Paul has in mind in this passage or not, we do know in other passages he clearly talks about stuff like that. And we know that the Jews, just like us today, have that same problem. Yeah, Ed. Gotcha.
And Paul says, but you're breaking the law to help them. That's just a dishonor.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, one other option you'll see sometimes in commentaries is that Paul is referring to something like a practice of trading in idolatrous artifacts. You know, like some people are collectors of items, and that maybe he has something like that in mind. But I think all of these suggestions you all are making kind of get to the gist of the hypocrisy of it. Okay, I saw a hand up over here somewhere and then one way over there. Yeah.
Could be a local Jewish scrap metal dealer buying stolen silver.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, very much. It could be sort of like a dealer in the artifacts just to make, you know, money off of them, and it might be hot stolen goods, you know, it's hot on the street that he's dealing with here. Sure. Ralph. Yeah.
I think he's referring a lot to the history of the Jews, even up to the point of their current time. I mean, Jesus said, you turn my father's house into a den of robbers. You know, it's not necessarily specific acts that he may be referring to that he has seen himself, but as a whole, the nation of Israel has sinned as grievously as the Gentiles, and that, I think, is his main point that he's trying to drive home here, is that this is about you trying to be more righteous in your own eyes, but look at your history, look at where you came from, look what you have done, and look what you're continuing to do as a whole, as a Jewish nation.
All right, so Ralph just made a brilliantly insightful comment, which is that when Paul makes this list of charges here, it's not like he's sitting in his office and he's looking out the window on the street corner and he sees a group of Jews doing all of these things right at that moment. He's looking at their history the same way that in chapter 1, when he talks about the sins of the Gentiles, he's talking about the long history of the Gentiles collectively. And that's the same thing that he's doing with the Jews here, which I think is absolutely correct. And Ralph, that comment was so good, I'm going to bestow upon you something I have not given out. I was thinking about this the other day. In a long time. And I'm going to do it even though I know it's going to cause the person sitting next to you to rise up with jealous rage as she used to before when I did this. Ralph, you get the gold star for today's class, all right? I haven't bestowed, some of you don't even know what I'm talking about. In fact, I forgot about it, and I was listening to an old class the other day, and Ralph actually got it then. And so, and then Sandy just gets green with envy and rage when I give it to him, so here. But yeah, no, I think that's great. Okay, before Mickey, there was somebody else over here. I'm sorry, yeah, go ahead. Great. Yeah, the thing about Malachi, well, a man robbed God, and he's talking about how by their inferior sacrifices, they're robbing God of what he's deserving. Yeah, which is, again, to think about the parallels with the Gentiles, that's kind of Paul's point about them in chapter 1. They did not honor God as God or give thanks to him. So they're robbing him in that broader sense as well. You guys are just killing it with these great, great comments. Now we'll see what Mickey has to say.
we're putting all this on Paul, but we got to remember that all of this is led by the Holy Spirit.
What? You mean the Bible is inspired, the inspired word of God? Yeah.
I think so. I think Paul cannot sit here today and take credit for all
this. Sure. No, of course he, yeah, Mick is making the point that when we talk about Paul's writing, I mean, I think it doesn't hurt to periodically just remind ourselves that we're talking about the word of God written by man. And so there's both the divine and human authorship here, and God working through Paul writing this. And yeah, that's absolutely, absolutely true for sure. All right, any other questions or comments going down through these litanies here? So we had 5 marks of identity, 5 claims of superiority, and now 5 failures. And then in verse 24, chapter 2, verse 24, as it is written, does your Bible contain a cross-reference that tells you where this comes from? Yeah, Isaiah chapter 52. I'm just going to swing over there just for a second. So, as it is written, and if you go back over to Isaiah chapter 52 and verse 5, right? Yeah. Now, therefore, what have I here, declares the Lord, seeing that my people are taken away for nothing. Their rulers wail, declares the Lord, and continually all the day my name is despised. Now, you might be thinking, that doesn't quite sound like what Paul quoted. So this is a good time to also remind yourselves of another point. When you read the New Testament, and an Old Testament quotation doesn't read exactly like it reads back in the Old Testament, what's the most common reason that that is the case? Anybody know? It's written in a different language, and it's a different translation. A lot of times the New Testament writers quote the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So think about it. Here in this assembly, a lot of us use the English Standard Version, a lot of us use the New American Standard, a few of us use the New King James and the NIV. And in those different translations, there will be slight differences in wording. And the same is true when you read the traditional Hebrew Old Testament versus the Greek translation of it. And in the Greek translation of that verse, in Isaiah chapter 52, this phrase is added, by you the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. So then when you put that together in the whole context of the train of thought so far, you had these guys in my head, you know, they're cheering when God talks about the faults of the Gentiles, but now he's made the point that God is impartial, and now he's turned to the faults of the Jews. And in fact, he's actually saying, you want to know one of the reasons why the Gentiles have turned away from God? Guess what one of the reasons is? You're one of the reasons. Because they look at you and they see, okay, these are supposed to be the chosen people of the one true God, and this is what they're like? Well, that must mean that their God is terrible, that that's the kind of a transformation he's able to create with his people. So that's the idea there. And of course, the same thing we understand, we have to be aware of how, as we who bear the name of Christ and present ourselves to the world, what is the world seeing in the way that we present ourselves? And are we magnifying Christ by the way that we live, or doing what Paul warns about here in this passage? I saw it. Yeah, Darren.
Well, that's going back to the question Jesus was asked by one of the Pharisees, what's the most important part of the law? And one of it was, you know, love God. The other one is love your neighbor as yourself.
Right.
You know, they push them away. They don't bring them to God, which is supposed to be.
Yes. Yeah, now Darren's just made a really good point that you see some of the same faults in the Pharisees. And honestly, there are a lot of passages in the Old Testament that talk about Israel drawing the nations to God, being a light to the nations. There's not just a ton of evidence they actually did it a whole lot. They tended to be more comfortable in just their self-identification of, look how special we are, as opposed to using that special status as a way then to help bring others in. So I think that's a really good point. Before I move on to the next section here, years ago, let's give my age away, in summer of 1984, I was in a program at Center College in Danville, Kentucky. And so every Sunday, a couple from church, the Ellis family, they would come and they would pick me up and take me over to worship. And some of you all know Tom Rainwater. And Tom Rainwater was a summer preacher that summer. And he preached a sermon I've never forgotten. I just thought it was fantastic. And he did a sermon about Romans 1 and Romans 2. And he actually sort of like followed Paul's lead in the sense that he started off, he talked about the sins of the Gentiles, chapter 1. Then he talked about the sins of the Jews, chapter 2. Then he talked about how the sins of the modern world that's moved away from God look an awful lot like the sins of the Gentiles in chapter 1. And then guess what he had the audacity to do? Talk about how Christians are often guilty. He went to meddling and started to talk about how Christians can be guilty of the same things here in chapter 2, which I thought it was just a great sermon. And so, in fact, we were talking about it again the other day. I just told him when I saw him how much I appreciate it. But it's a really good way to kind of think about this passage in the very strategy Paul uses. All right, now, Bible students, I'm sorry, Justin, go ahead. So what are you suggesting, Justin? If you call yourself a Christian. Yeah, very good, very good. Yes.
A few years ago, you did a sermon on idolatry. And essentially what you said during the sermon was anything that replaces God is an idol.
Would you all like to guess who my new favorite church member is now here? Because Sky Hamilton actually remembers something I said in a sermon many years ago. I can't remember that. So, no. Well, I will tell you this, Scott. That wasn't unique to me. I had read some people who made that very comment. And it's a point that over the years I think has really come home to me more and more to understand that fundamentally there are really only two kinds of things that exist. There's the creator and there's creation. Think about it. Those are the only two things that exist. And then our choice as creation is, which one will we love more, the creator or the creation? And if you love the creation more than the creator, you're guilty of idolatry. Yeah.
Well, in the context of reading this, of course, because of Greece having all the gods, the gods that they all worship, Hermes, every one of them.
Sure.
You would tend to think of it that way.
Right. Yeah. No, Scott's made the point that, you know, in the Greco-Roman world, they have all these, you know, the great pantheon of gods. And so there's just that initial root level meaning of idolatry. That's what we would think about. But, you know, even then, if you think about it, Ares or Mars is the god of war. Athena is the goddess of wisdom. Aphrodite is the goddess of love, which in the pagan perversion was sexual love. Hey, guess what they were really worshiping? War, power, wisdom, and sex. Hey, guess what our culture worships? It's the very same thing. So yeah, that's exactly what's going on. Thomas. Say that again. Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil.
Yeah.
Now, when you said nonsense, just to clarify, were you talking about my class? Were you talking about the sins of the Jews and the Gentiles? Oh, okay, very good. I just thought that was an important clarifying question to ask here. No, you're exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly what it is for sure. Yeah, very good. All right, now, Bible students, I want y'all to take a look at verse 25. Would anybody dare to go out on a limb, put your neck on a chopping block, really swing for the fences and take a wild guess? What above all else were the Jews tempted to put their trust in as a token of their identity before God? Just anybody want to dare to go for this? Yeah, so circumcision, of course. And so Paul says this in verse 25, for circumcision is indeed of value if you do what? If you obey the law. But if you break the law, your circumcision becomes uncircumcision. Would somebody like to explain to me what Paul's getting at there? What's the point of that? Say that again, Brad. Okay, so let's think about why that would be the case, that if you break the law, circumcision is useless. You may remember, surely you won't, unless maybe Scott will remember, but last year when we were doing an overview of the story of the Old Testament, and we were in Genesis, the Abraham stories, and I mentioned to you there's three chapters that are really helpful to always link together in your mind. The first chapter is where God makes the initial set of promises. Anybody remember what chapter that is? 12. Excellent. Then there is the chapter where God makes a covenant to confirm those promises. Anybody remember what that chapter is? Is that Ed just barking these out one after the other? Look at this guy. That's right, chapter 15. That one will be a good one to really remember because it's going to play a big role in what Paul talks about here in chapter 4 of Romans. And then, now Ed for the hat trick. Then there is a third chapter which talks about the symbol of that covenant, which is circumcision, and that chapter is?
17.
Oh, look, who had to jump in back there? Yeah, very good. That's exactly right. Who was that, actually, that said that? You're not in trouble. Oh, it was Wade. All right, very good. Can you believe Wade would jump in rudely like that here? No. Yeah, so 12, 15, 17, all right. So here's the way to think of it then. Circumcision symbolizes a covenant. Can you think of anything in our modern experience that would be a symbol of a covenant? Yeah, a wedding band. That's exactly right. And so, Cassie, you're one of our more recently married folk up here. Do you have your wedding band on today? All right, very good. Hold it up there, good and high. Proud. Oh, yeah, very good. All right. Now, here is the thing. It's one thing to take great, you know, Christy did not want one. She thought it'd be too much money, too expensive, and so forth. I said, look, I've waited 44 years to get some woman to marry me. I'm going to put a ring on it so everybody knows. And then, of course, as soon as she saw it, she changed her tune, you know. But anyway, so the ring is one thing. The marriage is something else. So if somebody puts great stock in the ring but are completely violating their responsibilities and duties of marriage, then that ring becomes worthless. Its only value is the extent to which that which it symbolizes is actually being lived out. If it symbolizes a marriage vow that you're not keeping, then the ring is worthless. That's going to be Paul's point here about circumcision. Circumcision was designed to symbolize a covenant. But if you're not keeping the covenant, then the surgery absolutely means nothing. You could compare it to the Ark of the Covenant, which also in a way has symbolic significance because, you know, it's where God is going to meet with Israel. But when you're no longer actually keeping what the Ark represents, how valuable is that Ark? What happens when the Israelites decide in 1 Samuel 4 they're going to take it into battle like Indiana Jones, like an Indiana Jones movie, and use it as a good luck charm against the Philistines, and they're not keeping God's covenant? What happened to that Ark? Captured. Yeah. So that's the point here, that you can put great emphasis on the fact that you're circumcised, and you can dismiss the Gentiles as they are uncircumcised. But the issue is, are you actually keeping the covenant that that practice is symbolizing? And if not, then the practice is meaningless, like the ark became meaningless or a wedding band meaningless. Yeah, Ed? That is exactly right. You've made yourself a Gentile. This all goes back to that key middle section there of 2:1 through 16, which kept making the point over and over again, God is going to judge Gentiles and Jews impartially. The issue is not what your family tree is. The issue is, how are you actually conducting yourself? So let's keep going here, see if we can finish this chapter before we run out of time today. So, verse 26, if a man who is uncircumcised keeps the precepts of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? Does that remind you of anything Paul said just a little bit earlier in this chapter? Look up at verse 14. What did he say up there? For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires. I'm so sorry. It's just about gone on my last nerve. I apologize here. The bell, it's like Quasimodo in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Why are there so many bells when we've still got time left in class? I'm trying to keep it together, Ralph. I don't want to lose my gold star either here. So, all right. So, it's just like he says in 2:14, when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves. There are some people, they may not have the law, but they have discerned God's moral truth and they're living it out. And they're Gentiles. They've not been circumcised. But if you were to look at whose lives more resemble what the law taught you're supposed to do, guess who it is? It's going to be some of these people. It's not going to be you. So, verse 27, then he who is physically uncircumcised but keeps the law will condemn you who have the written code and circumcision but break the law. For no one is a Jew who is merely what? One outwardly, nor is circumcision outward or physical, but a Jew is one inwardly, and circumcision is a matter of the heart by the Spirit, not by the letter. His praise is not from man, but from God. What does this tell us about what the purpose of circumcision was? What was it supposed to reflect and point to? Their heart, keeping the covenant. That is exactly right. That's exactly right. Okay, we have run out of time. And if all the various bells are finally correct here. And so we will pick up there. I'm going to talk about the purpose of circumcision as we move on, Lord willing, on Wednesday into chapter 3.